NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead. Well, hello, Todd.
Hello, John.
We're here today, and Greg is on the road, so we won't have Greg, but we have a fill-in for Greg, who has got shoes as big as Greg does.
He's a fill-in and a huge upgrade.
Yes. Miles O'Brien is an aviation analysis person for CNN. He's a pilot. He owns his own aircraft. I'm sure that many of our listeners and viewers have seen him on numerous TV programs. He's actually had me on some of his programs over the years. So we're returning the favor of the punishment and have him working with us. So welcome, Miles.
Yeah, payback's a bitch, isn't it, John? And it's great to be with you. I truly don't think I am worthy to fill Greg's shoes, but I will defer to the experts and do what I love to do, which is talk about aviation and what can go awry, and more importantly, what can we learn from it? That's the key, right?
Yes, and as we go through some of these, you may get as frustrated as I have been when you see over and over and over the same accidents. Pre-flights. I can't believe how many people, pilots, do lousy pre-flights, and they crash on next to the airport because of it.
And this is something that's right up our alley today. We're going to discuss an accident where a gentleman who built his own kit plane had apparently very few hours of flight in this aircraft and no certification either from the medical perspective or as a solo pilot, and crashed shortly after takeoff. Fortunately, the person did survive. But there are a couple of aspects to this. One, the mechanics of the actual crash, which happened shortly after takeoff. And two, the fact that this pilot had a lack of pre-flight experience, literally, with respect to the amount of time he'd flown in this aircraft, with respect to adhering to regulations, with respect to the medical certification, and as a solo pilot, a certification. But I digress. Let me have you, John, take over from here and your perspective on this particular event.
In August 1st of 2023, this individual was taking off from his local airport, and right on the airport, he had loss of control. And the airplane was substantially damaged. He was seriously injured. In fact, the engines were still running after the airplane came to rest, and one of the observers on the airport had to kill the ignition and fuel to shut the engine down as it was just spinning away. So it was a very unfortunate accident, and there's a lot of lessons to be learned from it. I would like to turn it over to Miles and let him probe you and I with some questions. That certainly has been his forte on nationwide news.
So, well, you know, yeah, there are so many things that were wrong about this day and this flight, and you know, potentially tragically, but very sadly, his son was watching this aircraft take off and went to the wreckage. You can only imagine what that was like. But Here's the thing that's interesting to me, gentlemen. These home-built experimental aircraft, which, you know, basically arose because of the litigious nature surrounding aviation and the high cost that comes with a factory-built aircraft. And it's created a huge, vibrant community of people who build aircraft and fly them. EAA is a fabulous organization which fosters a lot of love of aviation, et cetera. But if you peel back the onion a little bit, what you find is it's dangerous. It's 2.5 times more dangerous than flying a typical 172. So let's go through this for a moment. One of the things that is interesting to me is when you're flying an experimental aircraft, which is what these all are, the rules are different. Let's walk through that for a moment and how that might have created a mindset among this pilot, in this pilot's head, which kind of made him feel like he was outside the rules in some fashion. Todd or John, do you have any thoughts on that one?
Well, the thought I had was that the very nature of this allows people to self-manage themselves. In this case, there's not going to be an organization looking over your shoulder, making sure you're following the rules. In the case of this pilot, he had a solo endorsement, and I believe it was 2006, about 15 years before this actual accident occurred. And in fact, the airplane, which had a certification date of 2018, crashed in 2023. That's about 5 years. According to the accident report, this gentleman had 4.1 hours in this aircraft. Now, perhaps because he didn't do a lot of documentation, maybe he had more, but officially they can only document 4 hours in 5 years. That's not enough to keep up with currency. That's not enough to keep up with familiarization with your aircraft. And also in this case, he had been doing some maintenance on the aircraft prior to the last flight. And anytime you make a change on an aircraft, it takes a while to make sure that change isn't going to cause you trouble. And certainly this person did not fit the bill with being on point with his documentation and current in his flying.
John, we should make clear, his solo endorsement is like, 17 years old, right? No medical. So no private pilot flight certificate. So right there, you have to wonder what's going on through in his mind. But I think home builders think differently, don't they?
Now, they certainly do. And sometimes they think that the rules don't apply to them, especially since they get an experimental tag on the airplane, which means a lot of the rules that we know about are not enforced, you know, because it's experimental in nature. And, you know, a lot of airshow airplanes fall in that category. You know, I can remember Bob Hoover's airplanes all have experimental stamped all over them because they were operating them outside of the envelope that the manufacturer had originally certified the airplane with. So, yeah, that's the whole area that changes the rules, so to speak, because those people will operate to their own a match to their own drummer sometimes.
So is this something that, you know, I can see the good in all of this because, obviously if the FAA had been there, I don't think Orville and Wilbur would have taken off, right? So the idea that you can kind of loosen the rules in some instances, if it's only your own personal skin on the line, maybe that makes sense. But is there an opportunity here to tighten regulations? I mean, I guess the regulations here were ignored anyway. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, as far as the regulation go, there's a lot of pressure to go the opposite direction, to let this segment of aviation really set their own parameters. And, you know, and I think you're right when you said that your skin is in the game and that if you want to take big risks, then go ahead. You know, you're the only one on the airplane. And there's a lot of these airplanes flown by people, pilots that have gotten up in age and can't pass a medical, and they'll go over and, you know, we had some segments here. You just need a driver's license to go fly these airplanes. You're all alone. So the FAA sort of lets you go, but the accident rate is surely high. And I've seen a lot of them and shake my head at some of the flight activities I see. You know, there's these little fields all over the country where these people fly from. Well, fortunately, they stay away from most major airports, but it's still interesting. I mean, I
Well,
sat for hours watching them at Oshkosh last year. You know, it's fun. That segment of the business is fun, but I think the risk is even higher than the 2.5% times that you mentioned. I think the risk is even higher than that.
a couple of things about this event. We mentioned the medical aspect of this. Well, there's now a new set of regulations out there called Basic Med, where it's much more, I wouldn't say loose, much more open than a standard medical certificate. The thing is, though, you have to have had a formal FA certification, medical certification, 2006 or later, and you have to go through with a state licensed physician with a checklist. If this person was afraid that he wouldn't pass the test, perhaps not even basic med would have been something he could have achieved. So again, there was some incentive there. The other part of it is the FAA has oversight over all of aviation, but they don't have people everywhere. They don't have people in every hangar. They don't have people in every cockpit. But this pilot did have people around him. His son happened to be on the field that day. He took a video, according to his witness statement, of the event. Just about every pilot has people around them, close family members, friends, etc. They are in a position to step in, and even if they're not involved in aviation at all, if something doesn't look right, talk to the person. If it sounds like they are doing something that just doesn't make sense, take whatever next step you need to take. But if you were theoretically up in age, afraid to pass a medical, and you want to fly an airplane, it's time to have a conversation.
All right, let's throw one more thing in the mix here. It is the skill and craftsmanship and acumen required to build an airplane. Now, this is a kit fox, which is kind of paint by numbers type of building, right? But nonetheless, this is an exacting thing to build an aircraft. And the idea, it's kind of a twofer, because not only are you putting people who've never done this before in a garage for long periods of time trying to figure out how to build the airplane? Of course, they're not flying while they're doing that either, right? So it kind of, there's a cycle here that comes out of these things. And a lot of these first flights can be particularly dangerous for that obvious reason. Is there some, I know EAA has mentor programs and so forth, but is there a better way to kind of inspect these aircraft before they go in the air and at least provide some sort of check and balance, whether it's a community like that or regulators or something to assure these aircraft are airworthy.
Well, it would make sense for them to have somebody a peer review on their building, but I don't see that gaining any traction anywhere. In fact, what I'm seeing is expansion of the kit bills. We now have programs entering into our high schools where they buy a kit, and the high schoolers will put it together, and then they'll sell the kit to buy another kit so that the school can continue doing this. And where we in aviation have actually been encouraging that, because it gets people into the aviation. You want to be either maintenance people or pilots. Usually it's pilots that get generated out of this kind of program. But it's alive and well, and I know of a school that just recently received their kit to go forward. And sometimes these kits are actually funded by the STEM program from the federal government. And what they're looking for is build these kits, sell them, and it perpetuates the process for the school. So it's not to make a profit, but it's to buy another kit and perpetuate the technical learning at the high school level. So
Wasn't the idea originally to just require that you could only fly the aircraft you built, or am I remembering that incorrectly?
I think years ago that was the premise. And then we started building kits. Somewhere along the line, it became you could buy a kit because it's not a fully assembled airplane, and it could fall under the same rules. And it was in its infancy. There wasn't a lot of that going on, but then all of a sudden it took off pretty good. And kit builders, you know, there was only a few of them in the very beginning. They started selling rather robustly, and all of a sudden, other kit builders decided to jump into the fray because they saw the marketing opportunities. And now we have a very large business producing kits and selling kits to wannabe pilots or pilots, people that were pilots that want to get back to a more basic and easier flight regime. You know,
yeah,
isn't that what we started with, Miles? When did you solo?
Oh, 1986. So it's been a while, but yeah, that was kind of pre-kit for sure. But, you know, and I'm thinking about John Denver's crash, for example. Now, that's a class, you know, he bought a kit that had been built by someone else, and it had a very quirky setup for the fuel system, which made it difficult to really see and know what tank you're on or how much fuel was in it. And, you know, unfortunately, he ran out of gas. And, but that, you know, obviously what you have there is that, because it's experimental, because it's built by somebody, it can have all kinds of little quirks, which are probably fine if you built it because you know it inside and out. But when you go to hand the key over to somebody else, that may not be the safest thing.
Right. In that case, he had the fuel selection valve in a very difficult place to turn,
right,
and it had no handle on it.
Right.
So he had to take a pair of pliers with him to turn the selector. I mean, those are the kinds of things that pop out in this home-built environment.
In this
all
particular,
these things, because there are no standards.
In this particular accident, something else jumps out at me. Although there was nothing in the public docket about his flight logbook, he did have a maintenance logbook, and it appears that this journey of this aircraft was at least 8 years long. The first entry was in 2015, and at the end of 2015, there was 1.2 hours total on this aircraft. The aircraft was certified with the FAA in 2018, but there's nothing in the logbook, the maintenance logbook, until 2020, where we had a few more hours of work on it. And again, nothing in for several months until 2021, did a few more things with it. Another year plus gap, didn't fly it again until 2023. So 4.1 hours in this aircraft over a period of 8 years, where there are huge gaps where apparently there are no maintenance entries in his logbook. I'm not sure if there's any work being done on the aircraft, but the bottom line, from getting the kit to flying it the last time was 8 years. There was only 4.1 hours in those 8 years.
That is not exactly a well-exercised aircraft, right? Or pilot, for that matter. I mean, all kinds of bad things happen to airplanes when they sit on the ground like that, as you well know. And, you know, as it says in the report, he had been fiddling with the propeller, changed the pitch by 2 degrees. But, you know, it's interesting, as you well know, in classic cryptic NTSB form, they really don't address that. They just say failure to maintain airplane control after takeoff resulting in impact with terrain, which really doesn't tell us what really was going on there, right? Was it his inexperience, bad decision making, or was there actually some aspect of that propeller tweak that changed things? I don't know. There's a lot of blanks in all of this, but there's nothing in what led up to this incident which would tell you this incident wouldn't happen. It was almost like this was inevitable, the way he was approaching this.
There's also a blank after the fact, in that there was a note in the public docket saying that they asked the accident pilot to fill out the standard NTSB accident form, but they said in the note there that he never filled it out. So did he?
He wasn't following the rules. Why follow the rules now, right?
Yes, and that's the attitude of many people that fly in this category of airplane.
Yeah.
You know, they think the rules don't apply. There's no FAA around. You know, even in this case, the NTSB didn't travel to the investigation. They let the FAA do it, and the FAA, you know, is the one who's been ignoring this segment for a while. So it really is all those questions that you asked, Miles, and many others, are just left to wither on the vine, so to speak. Could they have done a better job of this to make recommendations to the manufacturers or the rest of it? They could have, but I don't think they would have been followed anyway, because it's left up to the individual. I think that's the part of the rules that maybe need to be changed, because you build the kit and you sell somebody all the pieces, but that person's responsible for the assembly and all that goes with that. So they are the Piper or the Cessna at that point in time.
And ultimately, the liability is the question, right? Which is why this all began, I guess.
Right.
Well, what I'd like to remind people and ourselves, too, we've talked about this accident. We haven't talked about the actual mechanics of what happened on this last flight. The analysis portion of the accident report is fairly short. It's a paragraph, and I'm just reading a section of it. Witness stated that the pilot performed a successful airplane run-up before takeoff. During the takeoff, the airplane lifted off and was about halfway down the runway, climbed to about treetop level. A few seconds later, the right wing dropped. Airplane descended into terrain in a nose-down attitude. And we've seen the picture of the outcome of that. So this was a very short flight. It would appear that he lost control, wing stall, whatever the case may be. But again, 4.1 hours over 8 years, just the feel of how it feels to take the airplane off, what a good lift feels like from the pilot's seat, what a decent takeoff run feels like. You don't get that if you've only done it a few times over 8 years. So even if he had perfectly fixed this aircraft and was tip-top shape, he simply didn't have the experience, at least in this aircraft, to know what it feels like to fly it, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you're right. A lot of what we do is feel, isn't it? Right? When you're approaching a stall, it's feel. Right? There's no indication in the cockpit to tell you you're approaching stall unless you're going to do all that math in your head. But you feel it coming on when you're at the edge of it, and you respond to it. But it takes time and practice.
You know, I'm sure you guys agree. And, you know, you can be a gifted natural aviator, but there is simply no substitute for experience, for time at the controls. You cannot shortcut that ever. It just doesn't work. I mean, would you agree? I mean, yeah. Some people are better stick and rudder people than others, but experience is everything.
Yeah, and some airplanes help the pilot be a better pilot. Mm-hmm. You know, and some of the training airplanes, like the 172, I learned in a J3, very forgiving airplane. And those are very helpful to novice pilots. So, yes, it's all feel and it's all experience.
Yeah, well, I think this is the point in the show where this is the first time for you, Miles, doing this, that we have the next to last word coming from me and the last word coming from John. And my next to last word, I usually
let's,
come.
No, let's let Miles give a last word.
Yeah,
as well.
That's right.
Oh, wow. What an honor. This is a great honor. I think,
well,
you
before,
know,
before you accept that honor, let me give you my next last word. It might give you an idea or two. And basically, one of the reasons I picked this accident was because it had a serious injury and it had a public docket. And looking at that public docket was absolutely essential because if you just look at the accident report, you have a whole bunch of questions. We looked at the public docket. We had some of those questions answered and other questions came up. So if you're using the NTSB database to enhance your own flying, focus on those events where you have some ancillary data in that public docket.
I would say, just to sum this up, I don't know this individual, and I'm glad that there's no fatalities in this case. But this is the hubris of this person to sidestep the very fundamental basic rules and ignore the laws of physics when it comes to aviation in some respects is astounding to me. But, you know, it's not the first or last time we'll think about a pilot who doesn't think in a rational risk averse or risk management way. I was just saying how important experience is. No matter how much experience you have, you gotta have a system that you follow, and you gotta play by the rules, or you're gonna get hurt.
The system that we use today in the normal aviation channels is pre-plane of flight. And when I give my last word, I'm always telling people to do it twice. Do it at home before you go to the airport, and then do it again at the airport. And if there's something different, then you better be looking closely. And then when you go out to your airplane, do a good pre-flight. Touch your airplane. Wiggle your airplane. Wiggle the flight controls. When you get in your airplane, make sure you're checking everything out. You know, it's more than just a mag check on general aviation airplanes. Make sure that everything's working right. And after you take off, put your head on a swivel, because the airspace is busy today with a lot of students. And You don't want to be in somebody else's accident. So make sure you're not being, find yourself too close to other people in the air. Pay attention, pay attention. And please, please fly safely.
Thank you for checking out our show. We really value our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you and how much you like it. So please give us 5 stars in your podcast platform.
We want to keep in contact with you. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're on YouTube, we're really working on growing the channel, and it helps if you all send in comments. Please do that, and we read all the comments.
And be sure to subscribe. Remember, if you're in the market for aviation insurance, you can save 5% with Avemco just by mentioning our show. Visit them at www.avemco.com. That's it for this episode of the Flight Safety Detective. Until the next episode, fly safe.